Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Lane Davis, and today I have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Robert Elder. He is assistant professor of history at Baylor University and the author of Calhoun, American Heretic, that's releasing on February 16th, 2021 from Basic Books. Dr. Elder, thanks so much for taking some time to talk with us today, and congrats on the publication of the book.
Hey, thanks, Lane. Great to be here.
So while I'm sure that most of our listeners are probably familiar with John C. Calhoun, I'm cognizant that we have folks from all over the world who may not be as deeply informed on the intricacies of American statesmanship in the 19th century. And so why don't you just give us the brief sort of Wikipedia entry for who John Calhoun was, and then tell us about how did you come to write about him?
Sure. Well, so Calhoun is one of the more influential figures in American history. Certainly, he's one of the primary figures in 19th century American history. He had a very long career in American politics before the Civil War. He's born in South Carolina right as the American Revolution is ending. He's elected to Congress right as the War of 1812 starts, and he plays a primary role as one of the so-called war hawks, kind of holding the country together and trying to get Congress to fund the war effort. And at the beginning of his career, he is a passionate nationalist. He identifies with Thomas Jefferson's notions of American democracy. He would throughout his life identify himself as a Jeffersonian. But during and after the War of 1812, he carves out an identity as a really aggressive nationalist who wants to prepare the country to survive another attack from a country like Great Britain, and also to expand its influence across the North American continent. So as a young politician, he advocates, brings forward bills for things like internal improvements, a national system of roads and canals. And he's a primary supporter of the Second National Bank, even though he's a Jeffersonian. And he's a supporter of the 1816 tariff, which eventually comes back to haunt him. That becomes the primary issue that his political career fractures against Andrew Jackson on in 1828. And then he goes on to become vice president under both John Quincy Adams in 1824 and then Andrew Jackson in 1828, which is a feat that no other politician in American politics has accomplished. And then after the nullification crisis, which maybe we'll talk about a little later, his split with Jackson, he comes back into the U.S. Senate as a senator from South Carolina. And that's where he spends most of the rest of his career, with the exception of 1 year as John Tyler's Secretary of State. And Calhoun is probably famous for two things. I mean, he's famous for his role in the nullification crisis and the constitutional theories that he begins working out there, and that he continues to work out for the rest of his life and kind of sums up at the end of his life in two major treatises on government that he publishes posthumously. And he's famous for his role as perhaps the primary defender of slavery in the pre-Civil War American sphere of politics. So he's famous for his 1837 speech, in which he argues that slavery is a positive good for in a democratic society. And that's a that's an argument that was shocking at the time, still shocking today, and yet it becomes kind of the de facto position for much of the American South by the Civil War. And he dies in 1850, right as the kind of crisis over slavery is starting to boil over. And so he doesn't live to see the Civil War or anything like that, although we do associate him strongly with that and with the Confederacy.
Right. So I'm interested in what kind of led you to him. But let me ask the question like this. So in your preface, you give us a brief little historiography of how previous historians have portrayed Calhoun. And Richard Hofstadter is, of course, always good for a quote. And I think his view seems to sum up the majority. And you quote him as saying, and this is his quote, "Calhoun was a minority spokesman in a democracy, a particularist in an age of nationalism, a slaveholder in an age of advancing liberties, and an agrarian in a furiously capitalistic country. Quite understandably, he developed a certain perversity of mind," end quote. Why did you feel that this view of Calhoun needed a reappraisal, and why was now the right time to dive into such a project for you?
Yeah, so I could go, you know, I give several of those sorts of quotes in the preface where I kind of showed that the view of Calhoun over the past 50 years, for sure, has been of somebody who is kind of fundamentally opposed to the flow of history, whatever that is, or however we conceive of that. And one of the things that led me to write the book is that the last biography of Calhoun was published about 30 years ago now, or 28 years ago, to be exact. And our understanding of the American South, of slavery and its relationship to capitalism in the modern world, all of our understanding of the United States in international context, all of these things have changed dramatically in terms of the scholarship that is available and that I was familiar with. And I really saw an opportunity when I was reading these older biographies of Calhoun to portray him as somebody who is fundamentally in tune with all the currents of his world and whose arguments are aimed at adapting to those currents. So you know, his arguments about slavery are that it's a fundamentally modern institution that's suited for the modern world. And he sees his constitutional theories as adapting the American Constitution to new circumstances. So he's, I wanted to portray him as a much more modern figure than we might like to think, because I think part of our image of him as backwards looking is an effort to disassociate him from ourselves, from the modern American nation. And then the event, the most immediate event that made me write the book was actually after the horrific shootings in Charleston in 2015. Soon after those shootings at Mother Emanuel Church, people began connecting issues of protests over racial justice to Calhoun's legacy. So in Charleston, there were protests about a monument there. And then at Yale University, there were protests over a college named for Calhoun there. And I was, you know, I feel that one of a historian's jobs is to explain the past to the present. And I felt like what we had about Calhoun was not adequate to that task at a moment mm-hmm. when people were intensely interested in his legacy again.
Well, your book certainly succeeds in that way for sure. Let's dive into some of the particulars then of Calhoun's life. You say early in the book that the young John Calhoun received a variety of educations as a young man. He had a kind of classical education, an outdoors education, a formal education at Yale, but also that slavery was a kind of education for him and that deeply formed him. And I found this idea of multiple educations really fascinating. Can you talk a bit about that and how you understood these educations as formative for Calhoun?
Yeah, so one of the things I wanted to do in the book was I thought of it as an intellectual biography in the sense that Calhoun's famously difficult in this regard because he never very rarely cites his sources or influences or those things. So what I tried to do was kind of reconstruct the environments in which he would have been educated. And one of those is this backwoods classical academy run by his brother-in-law, a Presbyterian minister named Moses Waddell, where he would have learned ancient languages and read Polybius and Tacitus and all these other authors. And then, of course, there's his education at Yale and at the Litchfield law school, which was a very modern, forward-looking law school, one of the first formal law schools in the United States. Both of those places, what was interesting about Calhoun's time at those places is that he was coming from the backcountry of South Carolina as a convinced Jeffersonian Republican, going into the heart of the opposition, in effect, the heart of Federalist New England. And I think he did that because he understood that that was the sort of education he would need to achieve his ambitions, which already at that age were very ambitious, very large. And then the idea of slavery as an education, I think there's a couple different senses in which that works for Calhoun. And you know, I kind of took that idea from Thomas Jefferson's descriptions of slavery as an education, which Jefferson lamented this, that many of his contemporaries were educated in a school of slavery that taught them to be tyrants. And there's this fascinating period in Calhoun's life of about 4 years after his father dies and before he goes back to school to prepare to go to Yale, that we don't know that much about. He worked, he helped his mother run his father's plantation for 4 years, and he would have worked alongside enslaved people. That was pretty common in the upcountry of South Carolina at the time. Mm-hmm. But he never really talks about this period. Yet this is probably the period when he has the most extended contact with enslaved people of his entire life. And so I kind of, you know, try to imagine the sorts of lessons that Calhoun thought he learned from that experience, which even in the case of people like Thomas Jefferson, who had this ethic of observation, empiricism, right? They're influenced by this Enlightenment empiricism, and Jefferson thought that what he saw was that Black people were naturally inferior to white people, and Calhoun, who was immersed in that same sort of education and sensibility, I think must have drawn some similar conclusions to that. And then the final thing is simply that Calhoun grew up in the in the upcountry of South Carolina during a time when cotton was transforming that part of the state. And it was bringing wealth and a degree of refinement and institutions. I mean, people were getting wealthy growing cotton in the late 1790s, early 1800s. And I think that implanted in Calhoun a vision of slavery and cotton as forces of progress in his world. And that I think becomes important later when he argues that it's a positive good.
You noted his ambition, that he had that very early on. He spends a couple of years in the South Carolina legislature, I think, and then he's elected to Congress for the start of the 1811 term, which, as you noted when we started this conversation, a pretty tense time in American history. Talk about that, and how did that period influence Calhoun's views of government, and how was he influential during that time?
Yeah, so he doesn't have long in the South Carolina legislature, just long enough, though, to chair a committee that changed the South Carolina Constitution to institute universal white manhood suffrage, which made South Carolina one of the most progressive democracies in the Western world at the time, not by our standards, certainly. But I think that's important to understanding how Calhoun always thought of himself as a small D Democrat and part of Thomas Jefferson's legacy. He comes into, then he's elected to Congress, to the House of Representatives. He comes in with Henry Clay at this very tense moment where war with England and possibly with France is imminent. And Calhoun comes in as this very new political type, which was a Jeffersonian nationalist or a Republican nationalist. He becomes part of this group known as the War Hawks, which included people like Henry Clay, who try to rally the national government, which against groups of both New England Federalists, who were opposed to the war, and other Republicans, people like John Randolph of Virginia, who are kind of the old type of Republican, very suspicious of any sort of standing army or taxes or any of those things. And Calhoun comes in and immediately begins advocating really energetic measures to fight the war, taxes, raising an army, all sorts of things that had no precedent in kind of Republican ideology at the time. His efforts to do that and his kind of firsthand view of the shortcomings of how the United States almost loses the war because it doesn't have a functioning national government or a functioning military establishment, once the war is over, those shape how he approaches his political aims. And almost as soon as the war is over, he becomes, right after the war is over, he becomes Secretary of War under Monroe. Monroe asks him into his cabinet. And in that role, Calhoun kind of transforms the military establishment of the United States, including West Point. And at that time, the Secretary of War was in charge of a vast swath of the national budget, much, much larger even than today. And it included things like that today would be under the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Department of Interior. All that was under Calhoun. And he centralized the authority, the lines of authority for the military under him in Washington. He brought all the heads of department, which had been scattered around the country, to Washington so that there would be simple, direct lines of command. And he established thousands of regulations so that the military and the War Department would run like a modern bureaucracy. He's really the figure that creates the War Department as a modern bureaucracy, which was happening in other modernizing nations all over the world at the time. And that's what Calhoun's role was. Hmm. And even before, I should mention that right before he goes into the War Department, he advocates and gets past this really ambitious program of internal improvements that James Madison vetoes. And Calhoun is incredibly disappointed by that. It's kind of one of the turning points in his career, but he could have been the author of, he could easily have been the author of one of the largest kind of government internal improvement spending programs in American history. James Madison had overcome his constitutional scruples about it.
It's so fascinating that you're talking about this part, because this is one of the most fascinating parts of the book. Because I always think of Calhoun, and I think probably a lot of people do, as mainly a rhetorical figure, but he really had a knack for administration and just kind of bending bureaucracies to his rule, didn't he?
Yeah, you really, and he saw it as practice for the presidency, right? Mm-hmm. He wanted to prove that he had administrative ability, and he did prove that. I mean, I think this feeds into why he becomes a presidential candidate for the 1824 election. But yeah, he clearly has administrative abilities far and beyond what some of the other folks who filled his role did at the time.
Well, let's talk about that 1824 presidency run then. So he runs, but he fails, but he gets something else. He's elected vice president. Talk about that.
Yeah, Calhoun is one of the popular candidates for president. And one of the strange thing about the 1824 election, of course, is that everybody after the collapse of the Federalist Party, after the War of 1812, they're all running as Republicans, as Jeffersonian Republicans, but there are, several different types. And what Calhoun has to do in that election is he has a reputation as a very energetic nationalist. And yet in his own state back home in South Carolina, and in the person of William Crawford, who was another one of the candidates at the time, and who is the head or the candidate for the so-called radical Republicans, the state rights Republicans, who looked back to 1798 and Thomas Jefferson's Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, and were totally opposed to Calhoun's nationalist programs. And Calhoun has to figure out how to kind of start moving towards that wing of the party. And it's during that presidential run that he begins retreating or modulating his nationalist arguments. And it's about this time, it's right at this time that that a second tariff is in the works, about to be passed. And this tariff is incredibly controversial back in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Many people view it as unconstitutional and are criticizing Calhoun because he had supported a tariff in 1816, and it was seen as a form of kind of nationalist tyranny. And so Calhoun, during that election, begins this shift very subtly. But he makes a visit to John Taylor of Caroline, who was kind of one of the old guard of the states' rights movement during this election, in order to get Taylor's endorsement, convince Taylor that he's not a thoroughgoing nationalist, that he still has respect for the division of power within the Constitution and states' rights. But he does, he loses the election, partly because nobody saw Andrew Jackson coming. And Jackson simply swamps Calhoun in most of the places where, like Pennsylvania, where Calhoun thought that he had a real, and did have a real chance. And then, of course, at the last moment, when you have this dramatic, not really a tie, but it the election ends going into the House of Representatives under the 12th Amendment. John Quincy Adams is elected president with the help of Henry Clay. And many people see this as, even though Andrew Jackson had won the popular election, and many people see this as what they called the corrupt bargain. And Calhoun is one of those people. Calhoun thought that even though everything had happened constitutionally, that these two men had thwarted the will of the people, and he kind of moves into Andrew Jackson's camp, even though he is John Quincy Adams' vice president.
Now, he's also vice president, you mentioned, for Jackson too, but that relationship had its ups and its downs. Talk about that period.
Yeah. So Jackson and Calhoun are quite close and political allies throughout. Calhoun had been Jackson's superior, his boss, basically, when he was in the War Department. And then they're close political allies, although there is always this ticking time bomb in their relationship, which is the fact that in a cabinet meeting in Monroe's administration, during the Seminole, when Jackson invades Florida, basically, in this cabinet meeting, Calhoun had criticized Jackson and said that he had done it without orders. And that's a whole argument that historians have about whether Jackson had orders or not. And Jackson didn't know about, and Calhoun never told him about, this meeting and how Calhoun had criticized him. And so even as their political alliance is cemented leading up to the 1828 election, there is this kind of ticking time bomb. And then after the election, two things happen that fracture their relationship irrevocably. First, there's the famous Peggy Eaton affair, in which Jackson's one of the members of his cabinet, John Eaton, had married this woman, Peggy Eaton, who had a somewhat questionable reputation in Washington, and Floride Calhoun, Calhoun's wife, refuses to visit, to pay a social call to the Eatons, which was a snub. It was basically an insult. And Jackson saw this as an echo of the insults that he believed had killed his wife, Rachel, during the election. So there had been all sorts of rumors about Jackson's wife during the 1828 election. And she had died right before he was elected, and Jackson saw in Floride's snub of the Eatons echoes of that kind of snobbery and rumors. And he went ballistic over it. He held entire cabinet meetings where the only issue on the table was Peggy Eaton's reputation, and Calhoun was kind of stuck between his wife and Jackson. And that was the start of their estrangement. But what put the nail in the coffin really was the tariff of 1828, which is the tariff of 1828 became known as the Tariff of Abominations. And it's in South Carolina, the kind of radical wing of politics in South Carolina began advocating for secession over this tariff, which they viewed as unconstitutional because it affected agricultural or cotton growing parts of the country differently than manufacturing and commercial parts of the country. They viewed this as an unfair, unequal tax that violated the Constitution. They also viewed it as the beginnings of a possible national threat to slavery because it was involved federal power. And essentially, Calhoun had to choose between his national ambitions and what was going on back in South Carolina. If he wanted to maintain a political base back in South Carolina, he had to come to terms with this radical opposition to the tariff. And he shared the constitutional view that it was unconstitutional. But he also wanted to maintain his chance at the presidency and his influence on the national stage. And this is what leads him to his kind of first real theoretical efforts, which is his theories of nullification, which he lays out in an anonymous document that he authors in 1828 called the South Carolina Exposition, that is an attempt to find a constitutional way through the crisis and preserve his own political base back home and his national standing.
Well, that was going to be my next question, actually. Talk about nullification and what is that doctrine, and then explain how that idea led into a very famous debate between Calhoun and Daniel Webster.
Right. Yeah. So up until Calhoun wrote the South Carolina Exposition, there had been a couple precedents where people had argued that a state could interpose its authority between the federal government and its people. Most famously, Thomas Jefferson had done this in the resolution that he wrote for the Kentucky legislature in 1798 in opposition to John Adams' administration, which had passed the Alien and Sedition Acts. But Jefferson had never defined what he meant by interposition, and other people like John Taylor of Caroline, who also held the same doctrine, had not defined how it would work. And then you had, outside of that, you had kind of two other extremes. You had the states' rights advocates who said basically that the choice is between submission and secession, that there's no middle ground. And those people existed in plenty in South Carolina in the 1820s, and Calhoun is very familiar with them. And then on the opposite side, you had nationalists such as Daniel Webster by this time, although that's not where he had started out in national politics, but by this time he's a strong nationalist who hold that the government, that there has to be a cohesive national government, that people have to obey that in order for the country to work. So Calhoun's theory is really an attempt to thread a needle through these things. And it is a radical theory because it would have changed fundamentally, although Calhoun never acknowledged this, it would have fundamentally changed the American system of governance for good. And yet, when you read it, what you can't help but be struck by is how Calhoun is able to work this out within the constitutional system that existed. So he believed that this option already existed constitutionally, and that how it would work is that a state, through a convention, which is how, you know, the people of a state were the original parties to the Constitution, and they would nullify a law, and this would set off a series of other state conventions in other states, which would also have to decide on the same question. And if 3/4 of the states disagreed and expressly granted the power in question to the federal government, well, then the question was solved, and a state had to decide whether or not it would follow that or secede. But if a state could convince just 1/4 of the other states to go along with it in its disagreement, then the issue was also over and they could continue not following the law. And Calhoun, in doing this, he's working off the theory that the original creative power in the Constitution, the people who ratified the Constitution, are the people of the states, not the American people as a whole. And this is his famous debate with Daniel Webster. Once it comes out into the open that Calhoun is actually the author of the South Carolina Exposition, and South Carolina in 1832 goes through and actually nullifies the tariff. And then in early 1833, as there's this standoff between Andrew Jackson, who's threatening to send federal troops into South Carolina, and South Carolina, Calhoun and Webster have this famous debate that's essentially over who the people are in the American system of governance. And Webster's position is that, the moment of Lockean consent, right? Locke's idea of the consent of the governed, that had happened once and for all when people ratified the Constitution, that the American people as a whole, not the people of the separate states, had ratified that Constitution. And therefore, the federal government had to be the last authority in the end, and that it was legitimate in terms of Locke's conception of government and everything else. And Calhoun's argument was instead what became known as the compact theory of the Constitution, that essentially the Constitution was more like an agreement between sovereign nations, maybe something like the European Union today, and that therefore states had reserved their own sovereignty and the ability to judge the terms of this agreement for themselves, and that any time there was a fundamental disagreement, a state convention, not the state legislature, but a state convention could nullify a federal law and set off this process of forcing the rest of the states to renegotiate the terms of the compact. So for Calhoun, nullification was this way of constantly refining the system. That's how he saw it. He saw it as a progressive measure that would allow people to challenge and expressly change the system so that it was continually a system of what he would eventually call the concurrent majority, a consensus majority, and that it never became, simply a tyranny of the majority that people were locked into. It's also clear that if we had followed that, it would have fundamentally changed how we understand the American government and its functioning, and B, it might have been completely unworkable. Right. This is what people, I think, rightly mostly point out about it. It could have been a recipe for perpetual deadlock, which some people, including Calhoun, might not have minded.
So by the 1830s, you note that Calhoun's sense of the country had kind of darkened. I guess talk about his maturing views during this decade, and especially his views regarding slavery. This seems to be when those views really are solidified in some way, or really come to the fore.
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with his experience with the tariff, first of all, which he views as a form of majoritarian tyranny, right? Mm-hmm. He sees the ability of the country to impose what he thinks is an unconstitutional tax that affects one part of the country unequally. That this is an example of the tyranny of the majority. And this gets him thinking about really what the nation is and how the federal government should work. And nullification is one part of that. But the thing that then happens in the 1830s is the rise of a very energetic anti-slavery abolitionist movement. And so in quick succession, you have things like William Lloyd Garrison founds the Liberator in 1831. You have the Nat Turner slave rebellion, the arguably the largest, most successful slave rebellion in North American history in 1831. The founding of the American Anti-Slavery Society in 1833. Great Britain abolishes slavery throughout its empire in 1833. And there's this growing wave of growing surge of anti-slavery sentiment. And Calhoun, who is already thinking in terms of the possibility that majorities could impose things on minorities that they didn't want, sees in this a threat to slavery. And he begins, really commits the rest of his life to fending off that claim, closing off any constitutional avenues that might lead to a threat to his way of life and to slavery. And the culmination of that is really his 1837 speech, where he really revolutionizes the argument about slavery and takes it from this old necessary evil argument that people like Thomas Jefferson had made, and instead crafts this much more aggressive political ideology that slavery is a positive good that is fundamentally suited for the modern world, for democracy, because it allows equality among white people, and for capitalism, because it resolves this tension that is emerging all over the world that people like Karl Marx are writing about, this tension between labor and capital. And for Calhoun, Calhoun argues that slavery solves this because it unites the interests of labor and capital in the planter, in the person of the planter. And what underlays the entire theory and argument, of course, is the assumption of the inferiority of black people, the assumption that they are unfit for democracy, and therefore it's okay and even right and good for them. I mean, Calhoun argued it's beneficial for them as well that they're enslaved and not part of democracy. And in this sense, I argue in the book that Calhoun's argument is sort of a utilitarian argument, the good for the most sort of argument. But it's underwritten by these arguments about racial inferiority. And that becomes his reputation for the rest of his for the rest of his life. By the end of his life, in the book, I quote, there's a meeting of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society in 1848 or 1849, where they call him the very embodiment of the slaveholding idea. And when he makes this argument in 1837, it's a radical argument that even many of his fellow slaveholders don't assent to. But by 1860, it becomes one of the founding assumptions of the Confederacy.
So in the last decade of his life, he really believed that America, or at least I guess the Republican vision of America, would be destroyed by imperialist ambitions. And it seems that he was somewhat prescient in that way, wasn't he? That the Jeffersonian ideal, I mean, it's always still a tension in American life, but America certainly transformed in that decade through its imperial ambitions. Talk a bit about that last decade of his life.
Yeah, so he's Calhoun opposes the Mexican-American War when it breaks out, which is kind of surprising considering that he was one of the architects of the annexation of Texas, which set off the war. But he believes that it would be, he makes several famous speeches during the war at these moments where it's kind of on the bubble, whether the United States is going to stop where it is, or whether it's simply going to take all of Mexico, and which is certainly what James Polk, the president, wanted to do. And Calhoun is one of the key figures that resists that that movement. And I say in the book, it is on the one hand, it's kind of prescient of Calhoun that he says, look, our system of government cannot be an imperial system of government, right? We cannot be a government that has colonies and holds other peoples in subjection, because that will weaken our own will to govern ourselves, and we can't extend to them the sorts of government that we enjoy for ourselves. At the same time, there's also a racial component to his argument that one of the reasons he doesn't believe that we can extend our form of government to Mexico is that they are racially different. And that in one of his famous speeches, he says, ours is the government of the white man, and we can't export that because, you know, culturally, racially, other people are not suited for it. And we also can't hold them in subjection because that would fundamentally damage our own form of government, our own principles, and those sorts of things. So he's a, he is a paradoxical figure in that regard. And he's happy to add Texas, and he's even happy to have the United States take large amounts of land from, Mexico that, that become California and much of the American West. But he is one of the key figures that stops James Polk from taking all of Mexico and turning the U.S. into a kind of full-fledged imperial power along the lines of Great Britain.
Well, I'm aware of our time, and wanna before we finish up, though, I want to ask you one thing. I want to return to the title of your book, Calhoun, American Heretic. And heretic's a very unique, it's a very powerful word. I admit that drew me to the book right away. So well done on the title. Why use that word? What exactly makes Calhoun an American heretic?
Yeah, well, I have to thank my editor, Connor Guy, for picking that phrase out of something I wrote and saying, hey, this would be a great title. but I think it gets at a couple different things. First of all, I wanted to kind of recover the sense that even in his own day, some people saw Calhoun in this way. So in the book, I talk about the number of times that he's compared to the character of Milton, Satan, right? That we talked about at the beginning, mainly for his creative or diabolical constitutional theories, take your pick. And of course, for his really aggressive defense of slavery. So I think it accurately depicts how some people saw him at the time, although certainly not everybody. But then the other thing is that I think it speaks to how Calhoun functions in our national conversation today, which is that we use Calhoun as a way to say what we are not. That by associating him with the Confederacy, which doesn't happen until a decade after he dies, and by associating him with slavery, which we kind of don't want to acknowledge that that has anything to do with modern America either, maybe that he's this figure who, by declaring him a heretic, right, by taking him his name off buildings and pulling down the statues to him, we're kind of trying to exorcise something from our national identity. And while in one sense I agree with a lot of that, in the sense that, you know, I don't agree with what Calhoun represents. I don't want a lot of those views to be part of modern America. I think it's also somewhat dangerous in that we shouldn't forget how central he actually was to our history. And so I think the title in that sense is a little bit of a warning that it's it as we kind of declare him heretical and banish him from our from who we are as a nation, we also shouldn't forget that he was fundamental to who we are today in a lot of ways.
Well, Dr. Eldo, thanks so much for the time today, and thank you for an amazing book. It really is quite an accomplishment, and it deserves all the attention that I am sure it is going to get. So well done.
Thanks so much, Lane. Great talking to you.
Well, Dr. Robert Elder is the author of Calhoun, American Heretic. It is out in February of 2021 from Basic Books. Definitely make sure that you pick up a copy. It is well worth the read. And thanks so much for listening to New Books in History. We hope that you've enjoyed this podcast, and make sure to subscribe wherever it is that you get your podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, all the major platforms to keep up with all of the best books that are coming out today. Thanks so much for joining us, and we will catch you next time.